This is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 159B. Page 678, we're in the appendix of the book. We're checking out secret doctrine references to Taurus, to Leo, to Gemini. Those are the ones we covered on the last program. Here's Virgo, the six signs of the zodiac, and the secret doctrine references. One of the most esoteric cycles is based upon certain conjunctions and respective positions of Virgo and Pleiades. My colleague Nicholas worked out a method here. I don't know that method. I can't repeat it for you, but it was not based strictly upon, as I recall, upon astronomical movements. However, if the Pleiades really are the central group, and let's say, for instance, are the very center, the head center of the one about whom naught may be said, which is our local super-constellation Logos, having constellations for his chakras, and if the... This is all predicated on whether the configuration we will need is predicated on whether the zodiacal constellations actually revolve. If they revolve around the central group, and there are problems with this revolution, then there will come a time when looking through the constellation Virgo, we will see the Pleiades rather than, as we do now, looking through the constellation Taurus. Of course, all this depends on our position. Whether we saw the Pleiades and the 410 light years away, whether we looked at the Pleiades and then saw Virgo on the other side, that would be one type of alignment. And will there be a rotation or a revolution of the zodiac such that, relative to us, the position of Virgo so changes that it is possible to look through Virgo and see the Pleiades? So much depends then upon how far away the stars of Virgo are. Now, we could, in a way, look at this. Going to be upload errors when I'm doing a lot of things at the same time, I think. So when we look here and we say spica or spica, and we want to find out how many light years spica is from us, because it's the foremost star in Virgo, distance, 260 light years. Well, in that way, our particular constellation is our particular constellation, our seven solar systems, of which ours are one, our outer are farther away from the Pleiades than Spica is. We'd have to look at all the stars. See, this is the problem. Can constellational integrity be preserved? In other words, can stars hold their constellational configuration as they are rotating or revolving around a center? And we'd have to have differential movements of these stars, and they might be beyond natural law. In any case, let's just suppose we don't know how long a revolution of the zodiac around the Pleiades could occur, but we do know, because if the stars would move with Spica, we could look through Virgo, because it would be closer to the Pleiades than our sun is and our solar system. But, excuse me, there are, excuse me, so many things to consider, including the rate of revolution of our system of stars, our seven solar systems, or just even considering our sun. In a way, there would have to be a faster period for the zodiacal constellations, because if Spica is any example, then it would be closer in towards the Pleiades, and we all know when we look at our solar system that the period of Venus is faster than the period of the Earth, and Venus is slower than the period of Mercury, and so forth. The closer you are into the center around which you are rotating, or rather revolving, the faster your period. So the sun would have a slower period, so the zodiacal period would have to be under 250,000 years. Well, that's fine in a way, except that let's take a look at Antares. Let's say we try to find Antares, which is a tremendous star. See, there are problems here. Antares. And disambiguation, that's not what we want. We want the star Antares. Star, okay, Antares. All right, well, and here are some, it shows you how big Antares is. Antares is the largest one. We'll go to the Wikipedia here, and we'll try to see, you're looking off more or less in the same direction when you're looking towards Virgo as to Antares. Spica, we're told, is 200 light years from us. So it's going to be closer to the Pleiades. How far is Antares? 550 light years. Immediately we have a problem. Because Antares, if this is correct, is farther than the Pleiades. So even if, let's just suppose that there's no way to look through Scorpius with Antares as a part of it, and see the Pleiades. It would be behind us, as it were. And this is the problem, keeping constellational integrity as that revolution occurs. So, getting back to the question of the alignment of Virgo and the Pleiades, it is possible to perhaps see, given the revolution of our solar system around the Pleiades, if true, to see Virgo on the other side, and there's a kind of alignment with our solar system, a straight line. It's even possible to have Spica, and I don't know what other stars, because it depends on their distance, to look through Virgo. See, right now we're looking through Taurus to get to the Pleiades. And it almost seems we would say, well, then our particular constellation, the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, is generally farther out than the zodiacal constellations. But as we've just seen, if we want to include Antares with Scorpius, the constellation Scorpius, it's not. We are not farther out. We are within the orbit of Antares, assuming there is such an orbit. And we would have to look at the positions of all the stars of the zodiacal constellations to see whether they are within a circle through which we can look to see the Pleiades and therefore be in alignment, or whether they are on the other side of us. Of course, we could still be, in a way, in alignment. Even if Antares and certain stars of Scorpius were very far. Matter of fact, there are some, I think, that are 2,000 light years away. But could there be an alignment then, if they were in back of us, as it were, still in alignment with Scorpius, our solar system, and the Pleiades? And would the Pleiades then be considered to be in the constellation Scorpius, even though our conventional way of looking towards a constellation to see a heavenly body that is so-called within that constellation, even if that would be disrupted? Well, you see, these are some of the problems. It's very neat to think, well, here's the zodiacal circle, as if it was all one circle with one radius, but it has differential radii. The different stars have differential radii, and this requires this requires of some of them such a speed of revolution as I think to be impossible. I'd have to check this out with my more scientifically inclined friends, but I think that is the issue. Okay. I think we can see that the assertions of esotericism have to be checked against the facts as we can understand those facts. Now, these are not necessarily the assertions of the masters, but of students of esotericism, like myself, for instance, and others of my colleagues, who come up with certain theories. And maybe even Kepler was such a student of esotericism in his own way. He certainly had Platonic views with his crystal spheres. And there may be something to salvage there. I think he was dealing with Platonic solids in relation to the orbits of the planets around the sun. There may be something esoteric to salvage, but we have to be very careful to check all such assertions and see if they, given what we know at the present time, have the possibility of being true. We've already seen that trying to understand these esoteric alignments of Virgo with the Pleiades could present problems, maybe fewer problems than the alignment of our solar system and another constellation with the Pleiades. Given the idea of the revolution of our solar system around the Pleiades, we would see it through or against the background of other stars. Now, maybe we usually see something. See, this is interesting. I just realized this, that if we see it through a constellation, we also would look beyond the Pleiades and find yet another constellation, so it would be aligned with its opposite constellation as well. We'd have to have, in a way, it would have to be behind us. If looking at the Pleiades, we were to see only one constellation, as it is now. Let's see how far away Aldebaran may be. Aldebaran in Taurus. It's also a supergiant star. Amazing size, but diminutive when compared to Antares, isn't it? Let's look here and see the distance. It's 65 light years. It's close. So, since we're looking at Aldebaran in the direction of the Pleiades, when we were we to Yes, I'm seeing the problem here. Scorpius, in a way, would be to our side, or it's into the back of us, as the observer. So there's no telling. See, that's the interesting thing. Scorpius would be behind us as we look towards Taurus. So it seems that we are in the middle of the zodiacal circle, as it were. Some constellations are, as it were, in back of us. Some are before us as we look at the Pleiades. When it would come time to look at Scorpius, we might find it far on the other side of the Pleiades. And then, but, since Antares is towards the Pleiades, as we look towards it now, when Scorpius would be on the other side, on the far side of the Pleiades, we might be looking straight towards Taurus as well, because Taurus is not far enough away from us to be at our back side. In other words, we're looking at two constellations at the same time. I see that I may have not considered that fully enough. But okay, maybe making a summary here, that the circle of constellations has very variable distances from the Pleiades. And if this circle of zodiacal constellations is to revolve around the Pleiades, we have some anomalies in terms of our own observation. Sometimes the revolving constellations will be to the back of the observer. Sometimes they will be between the observer and the Pleiades. Visually that would still be okay, but then if you looked farther on the other side of the Pleiades, you would still see yet another zodiacal constellation. See, so just imagine that right now we can look towards the Pleiades and see Taurus, or at least Aldebaran. Let's see here. We have the Pleiades here. We have Aldebaran. Well, we have a number of stars. Let's see if we... Gamma... Let's just look at Taurus. And I wonder whether we'd be able to see how far, let's say, Gamma... We have Aldebaran here and Gamma of Taurus, or Epsilon of Taurus. Let's try Gamma. Gamma of Taurus. So, there's a star in the constellation, Taurus, Gamma Tauri. And how far away is it? Gamma Tauri is 154 light years. Okay, Aldebaran is much closer. Our problem then is that Antares will always, it's in a way opposite Taurus, Antares will always be on the far side of the Pleiades or in back of the observer. But Gamma Tauri and Aldebaran will always be in an inner circle when compared to the observer. So, right now, as we look through Taurus, the constellation Taurus, Aldebaran and Scorpius is in back of us because we don't see Scorpius in the same part of the sky. But if the inner circle rotated, inner circle of the zodiac, we just have to imagine that Taurus would come around to being on the far side of the Pleiades. And what would be our own position? Let's suppose there was a position. We could, at the same time that it revolved, we would have Scorpius on the far side, and we'd be looking at both Taurus and Scorpio at the same time. Because it's not necessarily assured that we would be rotating at the same speed, that our solar system would be revolving, rather, at the same speed as the circle of constellations. Well, okay, obviously, I've made some mistakes in conception here, but I think the major idea is correct, that to get a consistent speed of revolution of the entire belt of zodiacal constellations is a great difficulty because of the radius, the radii of different stars in those constellations. In other words, the radius from the Pleiades to different stars. Generally speaking, when you look at a radius, a shorter radius will have a faster period. A longer radius, a slower period. If you look at our solar system, the problem here is that if that holds up and the stars of a constellation which are closer to the center, the Pleiades, will have a faster period than those that are farther, then we're not going to be able to preserve constellational integrity. So the idea of the wheel of constellations has to be explored very carefully. Obviously, with our puny little human mind, we cannot easily fathom other ways that that might work. But given the radii from the Pleiades to different stars, the closer in they are to the center, the faster they go, the quicker the period. Venus's period is faster than that of the Earth. Or at least the sooner they complete their revolution. Whether there's actually a difference in the speed of their own rotary motion, let's just put it like this. If Pluto were to complete its period in the same time as the Earth completing its period, how fast would Pluto have to be moving? Too fast, I suppose, for natural law. And thus it would go for the stars. So I know this is a technical matter, and please forgive any mistakes I may have made in this, but you can understand that when you look at the zodiac of constellations, the stars are at all different radii from the center, even within the same constellation. So having the stars of the same constellation move at the same speed to maintain constellational integrity is just about an impossibility. Take a look at Scorpius. Let's take a look here. Scorpius. Yes, Scorpius. Yes, I did mean that. And when we look at Scorpius, we find some stars in the tail, which I think are very far. There's no such thing as the distance of Scorpius because the stars are differently located. So looking here at it's Lesath and Shaula. These are the ones I think I mean. Antares is there, and this is Deltas Scorpius. Let's just take Lambda or Shaula. Shaula. Let's just take that and see how far it is from us at the moment. It's Lambda Scorpii. And we'll look for the distance. And it's 700 light years. And it has a very high absolute magnitude. And Antares was 500 light years. Let's look at, is it Nu? Well, we'll go by the name because my memory of Greek letters is a little bit, Lesath. Let's try Lesath. L-E-S-A-T-H. It's Ypsilon, yeah, Ypsilon of Scorpii. Distance 580. There. Lesath could possibly revolve in a period similar to that of Antares. Because, at least according to our present calculations, it's about the same distance. But not Shaula. And I've seen other assignments to these stars which place them even farther away. So let's see here. This is this Theta? Is this Theta of Scorpius? Theta of... No. I don't want the Theta state. Theta Scorpius. Theta Scorpii. It's simply called Theta of Scorpii, and here it is. Nice for them to locate that for us. 300 light years. Okay. A tremendous luminosity, you know. But so does Lesath, even more so. And so does Shaula, even more so. And it's 300 light years. So you see our problem. 300 light years, we're not, you know, when we're talking about our particular solar system, we're not talking in terms of light years, we're talking in terms of light minutes, really. 8 minutes from the Earth to the Sun, and I suppose another number of minutes or light hours and so forth, or light days, but not light years. So suppose that that Scorpius, Scorpius gives us a good idea. Because if we were in such a position to look at the Pleiades and see Scorpio on the other side, Scorpius on the other side, the star Lesath, or Theta, would be closer to us than the Pleiades, 300 light years. The star Antares would be farther than us, on the other side, apparently, of the Pleiades, some 500 light years away, and this Lesath maybe 580, and then Shaula would be 700 light years away. So we would lose altogether the perspective of constellational integrity. We would not see at that time in less than, it has to be in a way, less than 250,000 years, if our rotation, revolution around the Pleiades is 250,000 years, and we have stars in there that are rotating, revolving faster, there would be no way to identify, as we do now, the constellation Scorpius. It wouldn't look like Scorpius anymore. This is assuming that that wheel of the constellations does revolve. Well, chakras revolve. So are we dealing with some kind of inner revolution? And stars move. They have their proper motion. They have their driving forward through space. They do move. Well, I'm not an astronomer, but, you know, a few things occur to me about the problem of oversimplifying the pattern, saying, okay, Pleiades are the center. The zodiacal wheel moves around that center in a certain period of cycle. And we, who are members of constellations, which are chakras and the one about whom not may be said, like the Great Bear, Little Bear, of course, they are circumpolar. And our constellation and Orion and Draco. Anyway, that our constellation revolves around the center. And so it has its own period, and so do the other constellations have their own period around the center. It's too simple a view. And we run into anomalies which cannot be immediately explained. I worked this out once with Melvin Artley, I think, and we, in order to preserve constellational integrity, we, from our view at least, I mean, constellational integrity can exist if these stars are really related, regardless of how we see them. But in order to preserve the constellational integrity, we had some far-out zodiacal stars revolving at abnormal speeds around the center. See, basically, constellational integrity would be constantly disrupted if there was a revolution of that type. Because, you know, the period of a star 300 light years away from us, and let's just say that with respect to the Pleiades, it would now be in back of us, so it would be our distance plus 300. At this time, anyway, because we're looking through Taurus, or in the direction of Taurus to find the Pleiades, even though Taurus is closer to us, you see the problem. So you'd have, well, let's just say Scorpius is on the other side. It's easier. Other side of the Pleiades. The theta of Scorpii would be revolving so fast that it would soon break away, pictorially at least, from the constellation, from Antares and from Shaula. Pretty soon they would be dissociated if the Pleiades were their center. So this has been a long discussion about the difficulties of an oversimplified point of view. And every time, you know, I say, well, that's enough of that, I know I take off on another tangent here, or at least try to further explain it. But it did occur to me that we cannot simply think of two wheels, all parts of which are revolving around the Pleiades at the same speed, all parts of which in a wheel are revolving at the same speed. We cannot think of that because the radiuses or radii are so different that that would be impossible given what we understand of periodic motion at this time. So we're looking then for the truth of this heart in the head center of the one about whom Nambi said, which we call the zodiac. What is the rotation of the etheric chakra? And does it necessarily stay in coordination with its outer points of expression? Well, it's getting beyond what one can deal with. What is the principle we can extract from all this is don't jump to conclusions. And because a pattern is satisfying to the mind, don't necessarily accept it just because it is satisfying to the mind. Look into the details, because your assumption may be negated by an examination of those details. I know that took a while. And I know that at different times in this series I try to explain the same thing, sometimes more successfully and sometimes less successfully. And I know that these explanations are scattered all over. And I know that there will be contradictions in these explanations. I'm not a master, you know. So my contradictions might really be contradictions, whereas a master's contradictions are only contradictions in time and from a particular perspective. Do you remember that one of the ways of blinding is to speak of the same thing in different time contexts? It's true for the time, but not true for all times, and that we have to understand. And it may be true from a certain perspective in space, and not true for all perspectives in space. Virgo is inseparable from Leo. That's the Sphinx, isn't it? Okay. And the Pleiades, and the Hyades. Well, we know there's a definite Virgo-Pleiades connection. And if Virgo, Leo are like one sign, then the Pleiades will be there. And, well, you know, just from the configurative point of view, the Hyades are in Taurus, and we must look through Taurus at this time to find the Pleiades. Let's look up the Hyades. H-Y-A-D-E-S, Hyades. And here, I suppose, is some... It's a star cluster. And I wonder... It's 153 light years away. It's a little beyond. But we'd like to see that in Taurus. So here is here's Aldebaran, and we're looking for the Hyades within it. I suppose some of these stars are closer to us than the Hyades are beyond, a star cluster. But that's not satisfying. We have to see if he can draw this a little more clearly. So here is Taurus, and here are the Hyades, and I suppose this is Alpha of Tauri. No, Fond du Chef. Taurus the Bull. Here's the Pleiades, and the Hyades cluster in this constellation. Or at least visually, they do so. I'm not sure. These are the Hyades, and we should see here. Here we go. Here's Aldebaran. Here are the Hyades, not especially visible. But you notice that we have to look through Taurus in order to see the Pleiades. Let's see, maybe each one of these. Here's that group of Hyades. They have a lot to do with water. And here's Aldebaran. And this is called the Hyades cluster, apparently all around. What is the point? The point is that we have to, that Virgo and Leo are the Sphinx and were considered one sign. So in this sense, they are inseparable. A Virgo is inseparable from the Pleiades because of the mother aspect. Virgo, inseparable from the Pleiades because they both represent the mother aspect. The Hyades are connected with the Pleiades because constellationally, I mean, they are two clusters, and they are both in the direction of Taurus. So for us, at least, they are inseparable, and perhaps from other perspectives, they would be as well. So we have here a kind of psycho-spiritual link with the Pleiades through Virgo, and if through Virgo, then through Leo, which was one sign. And we have two clusters in the same area of the sky, Pleiades and the Hyades. I understand from Charles Jane, with whom I was talking, that the Hyades were very important in the Atlantean flood because they tend to be associated with water, with flooding, with tears, and so forth. So probably there was some kind of emphasis upon that cluster. Let's see here if we can understand a little bit about them. The nearest open cluster to the solar system and one of the best studied of all star clusters. Okay. And the four brightest member stars of the Hyades are all red giants that began life as A-type stars. The history. In Greek mythology, the Hyades were five daughters of Atlas. Well, there's Atlas. Obviously, Atlas is part of the Pleiades, so there's the connection immediately, and half-sisters of the Pleiades. So obviously, their mother was not Pleione, who was the mother of the Pleiades. After the death of their brother Hyas, the weeping sisters were transformed into a cluster of stars that was afterward associated with rain. So we can see the great rains that must have come in the Atlantean period. As a naked eye object, the Hyades cluster has been known since prehistoric times. I think that's all the mythology we're going to get. And that we do want the mythology because that's what's liable to show us something about the meaning of these aggregations. Now, Peter Kubowski has done a lot of work on clusters, and clusters, especially if large, may be very important as vehicles for a higher order intelligence. For instance, the star cluster of the Pleiades, unparalleled in our local cosmos system, 800 stars or more. Let's see what it says here about how many stars in the Pleiades. Okay, famous for the seven, the Pleiades, the brightest stars. See if we can find this. We may or may not. I mean, it does emphasize mostly the major Pleiades. And as stated, distance 390 to 400 light years. But how many stars are there? Let's see, we'll try it one more time. Number of stars in the Pleiades. Number of stars in the Pleiades. Maybe this is not going to be the place where we can find that. Perhaps not. But there are hundreds. The total mass combined in the cluster is estimated to be about 800. Aha! Look at this. This is really important. The cluster core is about 8 light years and the tidal radius is about 43 light years. The cluster contains over 1,000 statistically confirmed members, although the exact figures exclude binary stars. That's enough. That's enough for us to know, right there. We have an amazing research tool here. It may not always be the most accurate, but here is the Wikipedia, and the cluster contains over 1,000 statistically confirmed members. So, there's our 1,000-petal lotus. It's a very large cluster. And when we have such a cluster, the being that controls that cluster or rules through it or expresses through it can be called a superconstellational logos, not just a cosmic logos, but an unknown, a one about whom naught may be said. Over 1,000 statistically confirmed members. Well, we don't know how astronomers are counting right now. But it's in the ballpark. It's in the range of expectation. And maybe indeed that is the 1,000-petal lotus of this superconstellational logos, with the 7 major stars being as a jewel in the major center, which is the head center, heart in the head center, which is the zodiac. Just even knowing that much and realizing we're in the within the expression of a super being is enough to fill us with a great sense of awe concerning the analogical construction or correspondential construction of our cosmos. Well, anyway, you know, with the secret doctrine, one tends to get off into the attempt to confirm some of these things. And although I'm not an astronomer, at least I have to pull together certain thoughts that present themselves to me and see if there's any confirmation or immediate contradiction to them. Here we are at Venus again, and every time we get involved in Venus, we know it's going to be a lengthy process. So, in the second solar system, and in connection, let's see, where is this from? This looks like cosmic fire, yes, okay. Why were these included? We'll see in a minute, and whether we've done them before. In the second solar system, the second major solar system, right? Major solar system. And in connection with the method employed therein, another point merits attention. This fire of mind, which is really solar fire, has its source in a constellation until recently unrecognized by exoteric science as having any relation of an intimate nature to our solar system owing to its tremendous distance away and yet only 8 light years. Only 8 light years. See, this was all written at a time when the expansion of astronomy as we now know it had not yet taken place. We have tremendous knowledge at our disposal. The art is to link up the knowledge so that new perspectives on our life appear. The sun Sirius is the source of logoic Manus, in the same sense as the Pleiades are connected with the evolution of Manus in the 7 heavenly men, and this we have done. And Venus was responsible for the coming in of mind to the earth chain, so observe that these 3 have distinctive polarizations. Sirius, positive, polarized. Pleiades negatively polarized to the heavenly men. And Venus negatively polarized to Earth in a masculine incarnation. Each was a primary to the other, even though the polarization was different, or was the agent which produced the first flicker of consciousness in the particular groups involved. Well, of what type of consciousness? Is this a kind, are we speaking of a kind of cosmic individualization? In every case, the method was that of a slow evolutionary growth till the consciousness suddenly blazed forth owing to the interposition of force, apparently from an extraneous source. Well, very interesting. We had an intervention on Earth, the solar angels. It suggests that we had an intervention, or that the slowly developing solar logos also had an intervention from Sirius via, I think, a solar angel of a much greater status. A cosmic solar angel, where ours are only, in a way, systemic. But is it also suggesting that there was an intervention bringing Manus from the Pleiades to the heavenly men? This is the question, because after all, our Earth is a heavenly man, and Venus is responsible for bringing Manus, in a way, or bringing a greater flow of higher Manus to our Earth. Did all this originate from the Pleiades? And was Venus, we have to ask this, you know. If Venus gave to our Earth Manus, did Venus, like the other heavenly men, receive that infusion from the Pleiades? What has to be worked out here is the negative polarization of the Pleiades, whereby the heavenly men would have returned a great deal, or given a great deal, to the Pleiades, just as the Earth gave a great deal to Venus. And what was it, then, that the Pleiades really gave to the heavenly men? So this paragraph expands the excision that we were looking at before, the excise sentence, and it's always good to look in context. I mean, in a way, that would have been the thing to do, but probably too complex unless one is actually seeking to work with the Cosmic Fire book in a more linear way and not a topical way. The Pleiades, in the same sense as the Pleiades are connected with the evolution of Manus and the heavenly men. Now, what I wondered about this, see, I have said, and I would like to explore it, that it looked, you know, looks like there was definite intervention, kind of another party in the development of Manus on Earth, and certainly for humanity. There's the hint that the grand heavenly man is very much like little man, and that there was an intervention, a cosmic solar angelic intervention in the bringing of enhanced Manus to our solar logos. Well, that intervention was really needed on Earth because of the retardation on the moon chain, but the moon chain may have held our solar logos back too, so a cosmic intervention may have been needed there. But then we're going back to the time of the individualization of the solar logos. and the kind of cycle in which he would have found himself. The kind of round, the kind of incarnation of a cosmic logos in which he would have found himself. See, this type of intervention was not used on the moonchain for man, and it was not used in the previous solar system. What if, just for example, our cosmic logos is in his, let's say, second major incarnation and had previous incarnations before that? Is only during the second major solar system, not the first, that such an intervention would occur. So if there were individualization of stars, let us say, or of logoi occurring in a previous incarnation of the cosmic logos, it wouldn't have used that interventionary method. But let's just say that Sirius stimulated some kind of cosmic solar angel to intervene and bring a higher condition of Manas to our solar logos. That would have been an intervention. But when I think about the Pleiades and their connection with the intelligence aspect and with the previous solar system and with the great third ray in general and with the heavenly men in a way representing a kind of third aspect, I'm wondering whether there was the same kind of intervention. But this paragraph seems to say so. In other words, I wonder if there wasn't the slow growth of Manas, fostered in a way by such sources as the Pleiades, or was there really an interposition? They say a slow evolutionary growth till the consciousness suddenly blazed forth owing to an interposition of force, apparently from an extraneous source. And that word apparently, you know, that's a blinding word, and we have to understand whether the blazing forth really did occur due to an interposition of force, especially in the case of the Pleiades, because it does say in every case. So this is what you have to do, you know. You have to study and note the apparent contradictions and hold them in suspension for a while, and then as knowledge grows, the contradictions will straighten themselves out. So there looks like in the bringing of Manas to the heavenly men, it says like in every case, so this is the Pleiadian intervention as well, or interposition. We know it happened with man, we feel it happened with the earth, it's hinted that it happened with the solar logos, it's still along the Sirian line, but now we change to the Pleiadian line, and it seems to say that an interposition or an intervention did happen there as well, even though the Pleiades is so connected with the third aspect, and when we have third aspect systems, it doesn't happen that way, it happens more through slow growth and not through some act of sacrifice or grace. Well, we're getting there. I think we are there. Why do we have these listed? The logos, the solar system, Sirius is the bringer of Manas. How does it say? The source of Manas. And maybe we mean a kind of cosmic individualization, we might mean. For the seven heavenly men and who are working through planetary schemes, it's the Pleiades for the heavenly man. And here, notice, it's earth chain and not earth scheme. Note, earth chain and not earth scheme. So we have to think that the chain lords, no, chain lords are heavenly men also. And we have to wonder, when he uses a term like heavenly man, does he apply it to the logos of a planetary scheme? He seems to. But note the term earth chain, which seems to be one of the seven manifesting chains in the earth scheme, and he calls that the heavenly man. And we would think Venus, yes, would contribute to that. Venus focused its efforts within the earth chain of the Logos, who is a greater type of heavenly man, and the efforts were focused within a lesser heavenly man, the Lord of the earth chain, and more specifically upon a still lesser heavenly man, the Lord of the earth globe. All right, well, that'll be enough for the moment. And we'll say that this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure, number 159B, page 680. And beginning, I think for the way these are converting or not converting, I'll make them shorter. 160A, page 680. So, we will then sign off on this and start 160. I'm having conversion problems. If I have four programs or five programs in a row, the conversion is liable to be interrupted. That is problematic. So, we'll see you soon. Okay.